The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, Doc Savage and the Fabulous Five are here to tell you all about White Lines, Arang Dang Diggity Dang Dang, The High Republic, The Power of the Cities, Ungulates in the Workplace, Dogs and Cats Living Together. The first rule of MSP Club is don't get sued by Chuck Palahniuk. The second rule of MSP Club is also the second rule of Tautology Club. The third man is Orson Welles, and that's why the song is called Alice's Restaurant, because the Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 1053 of the Major Spoilers podcast. I feel that intro would have been better actually during Thanksgiving week.
How do you mean?
You made an Alice's Restaurant joke.
I always make an Alice's Restaurant
joke. Is that a Thanksgiving song?
It's not a Thanksgiving song,
but here... It takes place on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and here in
Because it takes the entirety of a three-day weekend to get through the song.
Yes, yes, it's a very long song. And here in Kansas, I don't know if, and listeners, if you're out there, please write in podcast at majorspoilers.com or hit us up on our Discord server. You can join for free. The station out of Kansas City or Topeka, I forget which one.
Topeka.
But every Thanksgiving, they would play Alice's Restaurant in its entirety, beginning at 12 noon, if I'm not mistaken. Right about the time that you're getting ready to serve the big turkey. And it's kind of like an annual event. Just like if you're in Atlanta, you know that as soon as Christmas hits, you are just waiting for the first drop of I want a
hippopotamus for Christmas.
Yeah. Oh man, when I was in Atlanta in the 90s, people were just going nuts for this song. So Alice's Restaurant, at least here in Kansas, I don't know, Matthew, did they play it this year or does the radio station even exist?
Oh yeah, they play it every year.
Yeah. So I didn't know if they still continued it. Sometimes, you know, people do something for 20 years and then they're like, ah, screw this.
That station gets sold a lot too. So
yeah.
So
yeah.
That's interesting because, you know, to Matthew, it's not a Thanksgiving thing because he listens to it, you know, once a month or something like that.
Probably like that. Yeah.
But that's kind of how what the Wizard of Oz used to be, right? It's like before that's there true. Were like VCRs and stuff. The only time people saw the Wizard of Oz was either at Christmas or Thanksgiving because it would get re-aired. Yeah. That's when they did it, and so it became like this holiday tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But now we can watch it whenever we want.
Yeah, and I think that's why I don't care to watch any of the Peanuts stuff or any of the Bank and Rast stuff because you know, all that stuff is available now, right now on Apple TV or your favorite streaming service, and you can watch that year round. But I don't want to watch Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving in July. I want to watch it on Thanksgiving like we used to when we were kids, but that's, you know, media changes and people's taste changes. And I tell you what, dear listener, if you want to watch Happy Thanksgiving, Charlie Brown, or whatever it's called on Memorial Day, knock yourself out.
I believe it's called It's the Great Turkey, Charlie Brown.
Yeah, remember, something like that. Remember, any movie can be a Thanksgiving movie if it's a turkey. Yaka waka waka. Dear listeners, what do you think about that? What do you think about being able to watch?
Tell him what you really think about that.
No, no. Tell us what you think about watching things only at certain times of year, or if there's a tradition in your area. If you hear Alice's Restaurant on Thanksgiving, by all means, let us know. If there's another song that your region, like I said, Hippopotamus for Christmas, kicks off right on November 28th, the Friday after Thanksgiving. Then, by all means, share that over in our Major Spoilers Discord server. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server absolutely free. And there's really a lot of really cool people over there. And there's a lot of very interesting discussions going on. Right now, there's a discussion going on about Godzilla Minus Zero, which everybody seems super excited about. You can go over and talk about that. Or if you'd like to talk about the Major Spoilers podcast pre-show or anything that's going on in your life, there's probably a channel for it. You can find a link to the Major Spoilers Discord and happy gifts waiting your arrival right now. Don't wait. Let's do some reviews.
Is Godzilla Minus Zero the one where they just like Photoshop Godzilla out and it's just John responding?
Yeah, it's, what is it called? A Fumetti? Yeah, it's a Fumetti movie.
perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Coming out last week from DC Comics, it's City Boy, number 6 from Greg Pak and Minkyu Yong. Tell us all about this, Matthew.
So he was a city boy. He said, "See you, litty boy." He was not good enough for her. City Boy, if you have not been paying attention, is the story of Cameron. I believe his last name is Cameron Yu, who is the avatar of cities, much of the way that Jack Hawksmoor of the Authority used to be the avatar of cities. But throughout the first 5 issues of City Boy, we have discovered that Cameron is driven by trying to find his mother. And in the last issue, he decided that he was going to make a city just go crazy, and he was going to find his mother, and whatever happened, happened. And it turns out that he was actually being manipulated by Darkseid.
No, not Darkseid.
Yeah. Well, not Darkseid directly. It's actually one of Darkseid's many minions.
Oh, no, not Granny Goodness.
No. It's actually
Sod.
Nope. Lower
than
that.
Oh, no, not Caliback.
Do you remember Mokari?
No, I was going to probably mention him after I mentioned, what's the guy's name on TV?
Gorgeous
Godfrey.
Not gorgeous.
I thought you were going to say that my
Glorious Godfrey.
Glorious Godfrey.
I was thinking of like Gorgeous George.
Yeah.
Gorgeous George. Yeah. Same guy.
Yeah.
No, this is Mokari's son, and his name is Dr. Mokari's son.
Oh, no.
And so the cities have crashed out into the green. And where there is the green, there is the Swamp Thing. So last issue, City Boy crashed headfirst into the Swamp Thing. There's a new Swamp Thing. Did you guys hear that?
No, I did not know that.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, there's a new avatar of the green. But the avatar of the cities and the avatar of the green have been butting heads. And at the end of last issue, Cameron discovered that the green has been hiding his mother.
Why?
And the headstone that marks where she lies. And so this issue features Cameron just basically going, you know what? Everything's bad. The whole world is dead. I have a Freudian excuse, and now I'm going to just go crazy. And throughout the DC universe, we start seeing the actual manifestations of each city. So the skies of Bloodhaven are filled with this giant screeching bat, which is weird because Gotham City has a terrible rat, and Metropolis has this weird dragon creature. And these avatars of the cities are trying to merge and turn the entire planet Earth into one giant big city that Cameron will then use to resurrect his mother and or a city in his mother's name. I'm not entirely sure, honestly. And I say this, and you know, if you've been listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast Network for a while, you probably know this. I say this as a person with documented mother issues. Oh my God, Cameron has mother issues. Oh my word.
So did his mother leave him? He never knew who his mother was. He had a bad relationship with his mother.
He does not know his mother. He never had a mother. Okay. Or rather, he had a mother, but he never met her. Uh-huh. And now that he knows she's dead, he's basically embracing nihilism until Swamp Thing and Superman and Batman sort of talk to him, and he has a realization. We won't necessarily go into what the realization is, but I feel like
should get into therapy, kid, and therapy's okay, and there's nothing wrong with admitting you have mental health issues.
That's probably part of it. But okay. I also feel like the fact that, you know, we're threatening Gotham City and Metropolis probably gives you a hint that this is going to come around to a good ending. But it does have a really, really wonderful moment where Cameron finally sees his mother's grave, and he's finally able to look at it and not freak out. And Nightwing tries to console him, and Superman tries to console him. And he's just like, I don't know. I can't believe I miss her, but I don't know her. And I don't even know if she ever loved me. And out of the shadows, Bruce Wayne, not Batman, but Bruce Wayne, I swear to you, says, just be grateful that you had a chance to love her. And a chill came over the room, and I went, this is why My argument is always that Bruce Wayne is the real person and Batman is the mask, but that has nothing to do with City Boy. City Boy has a lovely ending, and I think that probably the best part about it is that it is a Greg Pak joint. And if you've read Pak's work, you know that he really has a way of getting inside of the character's head. He has a way of bringing out something unique about everyone, something that you don't necessarily always think about. So when you see Swamp Thing or Superman or high profile icons of the DC universe, Nightwing and Batman, you think, okay, I know everything there is to know about these characters, but here they have this specific perspective. These things are happening to them. This thing is happening, and so they have to deal with it. And it feels really natural. It feels really well-crafted. I am not as much of a fan of Jung's art, but that's also a personal thing. It's not necessarily that there's anything wrong with it. I feel like there's kind of... sometimes you'll have an artist like, say, your Chris Samnees or your Doc Shaners, who have that very clean style where it's like, here's a broad line and then we have the colors and then we have, you know, very, very clean. This is a different, not quite scratchy style, but definitely a more impressionistic style. And the things that we see here, especially as regards Cameron, aren't necessarily superhero kind of moments. Cameron does have sort of a costume, sort of. Basically, he's wearing, you know, cargo pants and a cool jacket. And the jacket has an outline of, you know, a cityscape on it. And you're like, oh, cool. It's a nice little thing. It's not a superhero suit, and it shouldn't be. And then, of course, when you get to the point that Superman shows up, Superman looks cool. But even that, even my complaints about the art style don't bring this down. This is four slices of meatloaf for City Boy number 6. Wrapping up the 6-issue limited, which seems to be DC's thing now. And so I feel like I would like to see more City Boy. I'd like to see more of some of the other books in the We Are Heroes kind of subline, but I'm not sure if we're ever gonna. Eh. It would be...
Hey, tell people that you like it. Tell people you like it, and maybe DC will make some more.
Hey, DC, if you're listening, I like this. I also kind of enjoy Spirit World. Spirit World is another book in that line. Good book.
Yeah.
Got an interesting main character. I like that one.
I have a question. How does City Boy relate to Main Street from the Doom Patrol?
Danny the Street is a different person. Danny is a sentient street and or locus, genius loci, I believe they're called. So I don't know if Danny counts as a city, but I know that in the past,
I would think that if Danny the Street was in one of these cities that Cameron is causing to get all up in shape, he might have a few things to say about that.
Greg Pak, if you're out there, Greg Pak.
I mean, Danny, but then the again, that brings into the question city of boy. No, but that brings into the question. Is the Doom Patrol currently in this iteration of the DC universe? Because I know there was a Doom Patrol series where they were out rescuing all of the quote unquote mutants.
Yes. Unstoppable Doom Patrol is, DC is kind of in a, hey, if it fits, it fits kind of.
Only they had
right
a sticker they could put on the cover.
Right. Unstoppable Doom Patrol is set in the same reality as this book because Unstoppable Doom Patrol has Peacemaker in it.
Yeah.
Peacemaker is torturing Nightwing in the pages of Titans, and Nightwing is in this series being like, hey, I sure am Nightwing, the leader of the Titans. So the commutative property of comic books states that by definition,
Tommy Westfall is in this.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. That's who Danny Street secretly is.
Tommy Westfall?
Yeah. What's the slices of meatloaf rating on this, Matthew?
Four of them. That's okay. Four. That's one less than five. One more than three. It's the exact number that you'd want if you two were in a city.
Fill you up, though. I think that would. Oh, one other thing. There is, if you're looking for embodiments of cities, there is a book series that I read. I was sad that it only did three books in the series. It's by Rachel Aaron. The first book in the series is called Part-Time Gods. where we are introduced to a young girl, and this is a, you know, like a future time period where cities just kind of became sentient and other areas became sentient. And so she is kind of a person who goes around and collects. It would be the same thing as Storage Wars, but with apartments. So like when people die or their apartments. Wars. Yeah. She goes in and does that. But then we find out she has a special power and she has a connection to the city of Detroit. So it's called the Detroit Free Zone book series. And I'm sorry, the first book in it is called Minimum Wage Magic. The second one is Part-Time Gods. And I forget what the third one is off the top.
Part-Time Gods and Nighttime Lovers.
Night Shift Dragons. Night Shift Dragons is the last one. Now, they do have a whole bunch of books that are set in the world of the Detroit Free Zone. But just this particular one has a city that just on a whim will say, you know what? I think I want this apartment building over here. And so you may wake up one day and your apartment building has been moved somewhere else, or a freeway decides to switch to a different, it decides that it wants to go a different direction. So what you thought you were going home, you find out you have another hour at least because you have to backtrack on the traffic. So it's an interesting book series. So as soon as you said that Cameron is the embodiment of cities, that's the first book that I thought of. So cool. Go check that out.
Well, you know, if my house ends up on the freeway, I'm just going to stand on my porch and yell at everybody to get out of my driveway.
Yeah, you would. Old man yells at clouds. News 11. Out this week from Dark Horse Comics, it's Star Wars, The High Republic Adventures, Phase 3, Number 1. I forgot that High Republic Adventures had already gone through Phase 2. I thought that they were getting ready to start a Phase 2. So I've got a lot of back reading to do. But essentially what's going on is across a bunch of different media outlets, cartoons, books, prose books, comic books, and I thought maybe a podcast was involved, but maybe not.
Is there like an audio play or something?
That's what I was thinking, that there was some audio version. I know I've listened to a couple of the audiobooks in Phase 1 of the High Republic Adventures, but this is where everything takes place before the Knights of the Old Republic series. In fact, the opening page of this tells you exactly where everything's set in a timeline. And if you're wondering, where does exactly Andor fall in the grand scheme of Star Wars stories? It includes that in the timeline as well. So I found that very interesting. So Marvel Comics is doing Star Wars titles proper. So they also have they don't have a High Republic Adventures book yet, I don't think, or just a High Republic book. The Adventures tag at the end of this tells you that this is aimed at a younger audience. And so Dark Horse is the ones that'll say, yeah, we'll do Star Wars, The High Republic Adventures. We know how to sell Star Wars. We've been doing it for years. And the fact that they're now into Phase 3 of this, which is the next bigger arc of what's going on in the world of the High Republic and the soon fall of the High Republic. It's interesting that Dark Horse is willing to take a gamble on a book that is aimed at a younger audience, and Marvel doesn't want to have anything to do with it. That should tell you something right there. But anyway, it's been a full year since the fall of the Starlight station. And this was like it's a floating space station where all the Jedi were supposed to be a symbol of peace in the region. And then the Nihil attacked and they've been having troubles ever since then. Some of the Jedi have been scattered, including Padawan Lula Tolisola. I forget how you say her last name. But she is missing a friend. Or no, I'm sorry. Lula is missing and presumed dead. And her friend Zine is mourning her. And they are tasked with going out and trying to free a world that has been, I don't know. I don't know how to best explain this because I haven't read Phase 2. So at some point, the Nihil have erected some kind of barrier throughout part of the Star Wars system that blocks off everybody behind the wall, except for it's a Nihil or Dihil. I forget how you pronounce it. They are the only ones that can pass through the wall. And so it feels very much, and I hate to say this, it feels very much like Star Trek, where you have the Romulan zone and the Klingon zone and the Federation zone, and you have the neutral zone in between. It kind of feels like that, especially when you look at the map. But anyway, there is, some of these places have fallen under warlord status, And Zine and her compatriots are tasked with going and trying to help the people of the planet free themselves. And in the process, Zine may or may not find a lost love. And so it's really cool. The art is neat. It's certainly in the Star Wars vein. So if you're looking for people with tentacles on their heads, or you're looking for some really cool aliens, you're going to find them in here. If you're looking for some lightsaber stuff, there is no lightsaber action in this book. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. The thing is that I don't think that this is new reader friendly, because like I said, I totally missed out on phase two. So I need to go back and read that to figure out what happened between the Jedi and the Nihil that caused this barrier to go up. And I think once I understand that, then I'll understand more of what's going on with these particular characters. This is still an interesting read, but the prior knowledge that you need to have, I think, holds you back a little bit. And so I'm only going to be able to give this one 3 slices of meatloaf out of 5. Still a very good book. And if you've been reading High Republic Adventures, you're going to jump right into this one without missing a beat. And I think you're going to have a lot of fun with it, especially if you're fans of Zine and Lula. So go check that out. It is out this week from Dark Horse Comics. Have you guys been checking out any of the High Republic stuff?
I haven't been looking at it now.
Okay. You guys are not Star Wars
fans. Last thing that I remember reading was something about a zombie thing.
Oh, they did the dark droids thing, but that was in the modern. That's in, I think, the last issue of that.
So that's not like the High Republic?
No. That's stuff that is happening. And I haven't read that series either, but it's like all the droids are infected by something, and I think it is Nihil stuff. But there is an episode.
It's like some sort of a presence from beyond space and time.
Something like that. But for some reason, when that series was announced, it was right around the time of the second season of The Mandalorian, where they went on to the planet and they had to go down to the droid factory and the droids were drinking some kind of polluted liquor that was turning them insane. Do you guys remember that episode? I thought maybe that comic series was tying into that event, but I don't think the two are connected. But in my head canon, it is. So. Well, Star Wars is big and deep, and there's so much stuff going on in Star Wars. I think Dr. Aphra is getting ready to wrap up or just wrapped up. So Star Wars is still super popular, and you can tell so many stories set in that universe, and this one just so happens to be before the Republic fell. Nice. So go check it out. All right, Rodrigo, we are jumping ahead, months ahead.
Dude,
January.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, it's just next month. Holy crap, ladies and gentlemen. It's already December.
Stop it.
Only a few more weeks left in this year. Holy crap.
Stop it.
Well, there's only 3 more weeks left in this year. Holy crap. I got to get busy on some stuff.
And that's why I had to jump so far ahead. Usually, I only jump forward about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right.
But up to a month, right? But in 2 weeks, it's Christmas. So nothing's coming out.
Yep.
We're jumping all the way to January from Mad Cave Studios. It's Dear Editor, number one.
Oh, so you mean like when somebody writes in to the editor of the newspaper and they're saying, Dear editor, I have a problem with the way that you covered your news on this date.
It's exactly like that, except it's spelled D-E-E-R editor.
Oh, that changes everything.
Because the guy who is the editor is a deer, like he's an anthropomorphic deer. Yes, he has a human body, but he has a big old deer head with giant antlers, and his hands are different. Like I know what they're trying to do, because deer are, as was mentioned earlier, ungulates, so they walk on their toes,
right?
Uh-huh.
Which means that I think they have like 2 toes and then like a little vestigial toe in the back. So that's been turned into like a hand, but mostly it kind of just looks like he has claws. So
that's not creepy at all.
This character is not like BoJack Horseman, where it's like a cartoon horse, right?
Yeah.
Like this is a very deer looking deer.
So let me ask this before we get any further. Is the entire world anthropomorphized like Black Sad, or is this like there's this one guy who just so happens to be a deer?
So far, we have not met any other anthropomorphic animals. It's possible that this is the only animal person in the world. Mm-hmm. At least he's the only one we've met so far. And
that,
nobody
that guy who's pretending to be a dad who's clearly an octopus, though.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody suspects a thing. But nobody brings it up. Like, people so talk to him.
Is he an alien that is making people think that he's a human?
Well, and that's the thing, right? So the solicitation is like, are you a fan of like Black Sad or Chinatown? Then this is the book for you. But really, this is not like Black Sad. This is like Resident Alien. That's the thing that it like really makes me think of, because the main character is an investigator who is not tied to the police, right? And Resident Alien, the main character is a doctor. Here, he's a journalist, right? He's the editor. And he's basically following up on some clues, and he immediately gets tangled up in a web of crime and intrigue. And I was surprised at how fast this book is moving. Like, there are like two attempts on the character's life in like one story, in like one issue. You would think that they would like save it. You know, it's like, just, you know, end it right when somebody tries to like get him. It's like, nope, we're still going. And I was like, oh, okay, we're still going. It's like, oh, there's more clues to get. Like, all right, I'm on board for that. That said, though, I don't know. There's just something about it that's not clicking for me. I think it's the fact that it's a choice, right? And it's a perfectly legitimate choice that they're like, we're going to play this completely straight. This guy's a deer, and he's solving crimes, and everybody's fine with it, and we're not going to make fun of it. We're not going to, like, we're going to play it completely straight.
So the whole book is completely straight. It's not, like, pun-filled kind of stuff.
Right. So, you know, characters do, like, there's a character who is like, oh, hey, or, like, he goes and he meets up with this person, and this person has a big pool, and there's, like, pretty girls in the pool, like, hanging out, and he's like, oh, I hope my girls didn't make you horny, and he's like, they're antlers, don't say that to me. And that's about the only time that we really get something about that. But he does have basically deer powers, because his antlers are functional antlers, which are weapons, and he does use them to fight. And also he has a very good sense of smell. Like a supernatural, like Wolverine level sense of smell, where he can be like, oh, somebody whose smell I recognize was here in this room yesterday, right? That sort of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he, like how Harry in Resident Alien has sort of like tactile, like psychic powers where he can kind of sense things. Uh-huh. This guy has a super sense of smell, which is like, it's a good, like, I'm a detective, so I have a good detective power, but it's not like an overwhelmingly powerful thing where like he can just like see the past or see the future or whatever. I think this book sort of needs to cheat one way or the other. Uh-huh. Either you play it completely straight, but the people in the world are sort of like
unfazed.
Yeah, either no, the other way around. And the people of the world are like disturbed by him.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Or you play it for the weirdness and nobody cares, right? And then you're just constantly having these weird situations that manifest because he's a deer, and everybody's like, oh, well, did you have to pee on that plant? And he's like, yes, I did, because it's that time of the day, you know, or something like that.
Well, yeah, that's why I'm wondering. That's why I asked if they were playing a lot of this stuff up for jokes, because I'm reading the solicitation here, and the character's name is Bucky.
Yep.
And he's tracking down a series of John Doe slayings.
Oh.
Yep.
So that's why I was wondering: is this? I mean,
And yet it is played completely straight.
But then again, Black Sad is kind of that way too, right? I mean, they make a lot of jokes that are like, oh, your girlfriend poodle is sure looking fancy or something. You know, they'll make some joke about the animal part of the character, but still play it straight.
Yeah, Black Sad's a mess though. Like,
oh yeah.
I mean, it really is, because like when everybody's an animal, it's like, how do animals work? Right. It's like,
it's the poodle, I remember there's Poopy a gambit.
There's a scene where like Black Sad's talking to this guy who's a bird. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, I was going to, like, jump and kill myself. But then I decided not to do is like, haha, a bird who can't fly. Isn't it ironic? And I'm like, no, it's not. In this world, no birds can fly.
Right.
Like, all birds have arms, so they have people arms. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, it causes problems. In this, there's only one animal guy. And we haven't seen any others. There might be others. And everybody plays this, like, this book, in my opinion, plays it too straight. There are some like cheeky things, like, oh, it's John Doe, but nobody hammers it, right? Nobody hits that, nobody chuckles at it, nobody hits the button, nobody does anything. Mm-hmm. Everybody's just like playing it straight, mm-hmm. and so it feels like you go through this entire issue without that payoff, right? Like, the detective story is fine, like it's a perfectly functional detective story, and you know, it's like you could like. We read Doc Savage, right?
Right.
We're going to talk about that later. Doc Savage basically has superpowers, but he's a normal person, right? Yes. So it's like you can have a story, a pulp story, where you have a slightly bordering on supernatural ability to do something, right? A guy with a super sense of smell would make a fine sort of late pulp type of detective, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like the detective part of it is fine. The deer part, though, I felt like I was waiting the whole time for a punchline that never came. So I'm going to give it 3 slices of meatloaf. The art is good. You know, it looks like a freaking normal deer, which is off-putting. But then the book, I feel, the writing doesn't follow up on that. So 3 slices of meatloaf. It's not bad. It's definitely above average. I'm curious to see where it goes, but I'm not beating down the doors to get the next issue.
All right. All right, very good. That's interesting.
You felt the deer pressure. Mm. Oh, you of all people.
Oh, dear listeners, you can find more reviews over at the majorspoilers.com website. And we want to take a moment and thank everyone who's part of the show, whether it's one of our contributors, whether it's one of our regular guests, or whether it's you, one of our patrons. And this week, we are sending out a big thank you to David, who became our newest patron last week. Thank you so much, David. And dear listener, we are waiting to give you a shout out right here on this show. It's the first of the month, plenty of time to get on board. And guess what? As a treat to us, because you've been a good boy and or girl this year, we are giving you a discount. When you sign up for a full year in advance, you get, I think, 2 months free. 2 months free. When you sign up for a full year in advance. So go check us out at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Are you on the good list or the naughty list, Rodrigo?
I guess if we're still being measured by the same criteria, definitely in the naughty list. I do not go to sleep at a reasonable hour.
I'm sure you don't eat all your vegetables.
I do eat all my vegetables because I eat a lot. If there are fruits and vegetables in the house, I will eat them. So I guess maybe that balances out. So I'm only getting about half a stocking worth of coal.
Okay. What about you, Matthew?
Oh, what do I care?
Okay.
All right. I mean, I'll get 8 mediocre games.
There you go.
It's like, no matter what.
Exactly. Yeah. And the Krimica Dragon comes to my house regardless.
All right. Very cool. Dear listener, if you've been naughty or nice, head over to the Discord server and let us know. I don't know if the robot overlord has a response for naughty or nice, but I'm sure somebody will get on that right away. As Rodrigo mentioned just a moment ago, we're taking a look at a couple of Doc Savage tales. These all the way from 1972 from Marvel Comics. Now, Doc Savage first appeared in 1936 in pulp magazines and was a huge sensation. He has been in obviously a number of magazines and book reprints and original stories and comic books. So many. I think every comic book publisher, I don't think Boom Studios has, but I'm pretty sure Dynamite has. Archie has not, I can tell you that. But it seems like every comic book publisher has taken a crack at Doc Savage. And this week, we're looking at the first four issues of the Doc Savage series from Marvel Comics 1972 from Roy Thomas and Steve Englehart with art by Ross Andrew. And the first two issues in this is the retelling of The Man of Bronze, the very first story of Doc Savage. The second two issues are looking at Death in Silver, which I want to say is like the third or fourth book in the series. So there you go with that. Here's the thing I want to say about the 1970s. The 1970s had this weird, and I mean weird, fascination with the early 1900s through about the 1920s and 30s. Like, you know, ragtime music became super popular again in the 1970s. I remember, like, wallpaper suddenly had this antiquated look to it. Like, you'd go into bathrooms and they'd have this really,
like, it was brocade or something.
Yeah. It was just this weird fascination with everything from the, you know, 1900s to about 1920, 1930. And that's fine, because every, it seems like every generation has a fascination with something that is, you know, 40 years old, like the 1980s and the 1990s, I think right now are starting to become popular again. And that's fine. Bring back some of the looks. I can finally sell off some of my clothes and call them vintage and make a bundle off of them. But the other thing about the 1970s, as they are portraying the 1920s and the 1930s, whether you're looking at The Sting or whether you're looking at a TV show, whether you're looking at Bonnie and Clyde, they all have this weird 1970s vibe to them. Right? So it's like, yeah, we made this outfit look like it could have come from the 1920s, but we're putting our 1970s feeling of what 1920s clothing would look like. You know what I'm talking about, Matthew? You lived through this time.
Every appearance of Monk in this comic book, is that what you're
talking? Yeah. No, I'm talking about Doc Savage, because it is this really weird thing that Doc Savage in this series, in all four of these books, is a man who is dressed in skin tight white pants and a vest with no shirt.
Yeah.
And it is like, we got a really high pop collar. That is a very 1970s look that you're trying to apply onto these characters. However, most of the cars that we see in this series are period cars, maybe even older in the case of Doc's Doc One. Monk looks like he could be a college kid on campus in 1965.
Yeah, Monk looks like a little beatnik to me, and it cracks me up.
Yeah, and the rest, I think, would all be what we would consider period piece garb. But the appearance of Doc Savage in this book is the one thing that I always, ever since I first saw this, the first issue, and was picking up the original issues, not in 1972, but afterwards, I was always like, where did they even come up with the idea that this is how Doc dresses? Because if you read the original pulps, he doesn't dress like that. He doesn't dress like that at all. He wears normal clothes. Yeah. When, what's his name, started doing the painted covers for the Bantam books in the 1970s, which just coincided with Bama, started doing those covers in the 1970s to coincide with that. This comic book series also was releasing at the same time. That's where we start to get the ripped shirt that we see. But that is a period cotton shirt that just gets ripped because Doc is so muscular that every time he performs some street of a feat of Herculean strength, his shirt just blows apart because he got so many muscles, man. So I don't know where the heck they got this look for Doc Savage in this comic. And quite frankly, it is a huge turnoff for me.
It comes from the mind of Ross Andrew. Ross Andrew drew Wonder Woman, not Supergirl, drew Wonder Woman for a very, very long time and just did wild and bizarre things for reasons that remain obscure. And I think it's just a design choice on his part. But I really love the fact that the very first splash page of issue one of this Doc Savage book has this complete superhero moment with the, you know, the character, the members of the Fabulous Five, which is to say, I think it's Mistress Tiger, Master Splinter, never mind. Anyway, they're all like leaping out like the X-Men, but this is before the X-Men. This is 1972, so the all-new X-Men hadn't leaped out of the cover yet. And I really feel like what we're seeing is sort of a distillation of comics shorthand of the period. You know what I mean? Sure. So Doc's big popped collar looks a little Dracula. It looks a little, you know, Drax the Destroyer.
I mean, it looks very much Elvis. I mean, it's an Elvis popped collar.
Oh, absolutely. And you do have moments in here where there is a big panel in issue four where we finally see that Doc is actually wearing jodhpurs because he's swimming. And so he's wearing jodhpurs and a bubble helmet because why not?
So,
but it's this really gorgeous moment. It's just like pure 1972 comic.
Oh no, there's some really cool
with Doc Savage.
There are some really cool art pages in this. And I think that Andrew does a really interesting job in when he gets to compose things and when he gets to put a lot of detail in it. I think it looks really, really cool. But some of the choices are just head scratchers. Now, as far as the technology goes, I'm a little bit more forgiving on that because Doc Savage was always way ahead of whatever the technology was at the time. So I have a feeling that when the books were being written, that somebody was picking up a copy of Popular Mechanics and seeing what the in 10 years, this is how we will, communicate, and being like, oh crap, I am taking that and I am putting that right into the pages of Doc Savage. And so
authors are huge nerds. They're always looking for that stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I have a feeling, so I can be very forgiving about that. And I think that's probably how Lester Dent approached that stuff, or as his name, Kenneth Rubson, would be like. So I can kind of forgive that. I'm interested in Rodrigo's take on our first story, The Man of Bronze. Because we get to go down into South America and discover the source of Doc's fabulous fortune.
Yes, it is.
I had something in my throat.
No, I mean, it is just like the most openly racist thing I've read in a while.
Yeah.
And we've delved pretty deep in some places. So here's a selection. There's a guy who's trying to kill him. This guy has like a sniper rifle. And so they catch up to him and he's wearing a weird costume, which is like, whatever. Doc Savage takes one look at him and he's like, I bet this guy speaks ancient Mayan, which means I'm the only one who can understand him. And then he says, I'm going to try hypnotism. If he is of a savage race, he is probably susceptible. Most primitive people hypnotize themselves during rituals to, quote unquote, their pagan gods. And the best part about it is that it doesn't work and the guy kicks him in the face. Which
I speak English.
Which the book doesn't play as like Doc making a mistake. Like it just kind of it's a tactic that doesn't work, but I think it's funny to imagine that actually all of this is just like racist pseudoscience. It was never gonna work and he got kicked in the face because of it. Later on they go down and they're like, yes, the ancient Mayans who disappeared from, and I'm like, dude, like they're like, the Mayas still exist. I used to live in southern Mexico. I like there were shows, like there were TV shows in Maya, like they're still around. Right. So just putting that out there, if anybody's picking this up, it's interesting because you think like, oh, this has some you know, you're looking at it and you're like, this has some real 1970s sensibilities. And I read this and I'm like, this really feels like a 1920s comic.
Yeah, it definitely has. I mean, they are definitely pulling some of the choicest bits from the original book and putting them in here. I mean, all the beats are here. So that's interesting and also somewhat troubling. It is super problematic.
While we're talking about the language, who's the writer again on this?
Steve Englehart, with Roy Thomas as the editor and plotter.
Okay. So, there is one member of Doc Savage's crew. It's like, they all have like very distinct ways in which they talk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There's one member who is like a very smart person.
He just uses big words.
Uses big words.
Yeah.
Is that pulled from the book?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I was like, this is a not smart person's version of what talking like a smart person is.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is like a character choice. Like it's if they're definitely... like, this guy's actually not this smart, but he's trying to sound smarter than he is. Or if the author is like, let me look up a word, tenebrous.
Yes. No, it is very much. So all of Doc's compatriots. So we've got Doc, who at the time stood 6 feet tall. Today, that would be pretty average. But back then, that was a giant among men. He's not really made of bronze. His skin is very dark in color because of, you know, exposure to the sun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Giant widows.
Because he's actually Mexican. He just doesn't wear
anything. Probably. I mean, we don't really know, from my memory, we don't know much about Doc's mother. We know about his father because his father is a rich industrialist guy. Then we have Lieutenant Mayfair, Monk.
Right.
And Monk. He's supposed to look simian in nature. He's an industrial chemist.
Maybe not quite this simian.
Oh,
Ross.
No. In fact, the books would have him more simian, like really covered in thick hair, like head to toe kind of stuff. Then you have Brigadier Brooks Ham. Mm-hmm. He is a lawyer. The reason why he's called Ham is because Monk, as a joke, Brooks gave Monk a monkey because Brooks liked to ham it up. Monk has a pet pig named, God dang, what is the pig's name? I want to say it's named after the lawyer Brooks. Yeah, but Brooks is Brigadier Ham is a lawyer, and he's probably supposed to be one of the best. Then you got Rennie Renwick. He is a construction engineer, and he has these big hands. His hands are like bigger than normal, and so he's able to pound things down with his fists. Then you have Long Tom Roberts. He is the electrical wizard of the group. He's the one that has the is he the one with the language? I forget. And then you've got Johnny Littlejohn. It's
Johnny who's all about the long words.
Yeah, because he's an archaeologist and a geologist.
Yeah.
So those are his team.
Here's the other thing. This character, Little Johnny or whatever.
Yeah.
He speaks on like two panels and then never again for the remainder of of this, because I was looking for it. I was like, I need to understand what this character's deal is. And he never speaks again.
It is funny because in most of the adventures in the books, and we see that in the Death in Silver. The second one.
Yeah.
Where it's mostly Doc and usually Brigadier Brooks or Monk Mayfair tagging along. The others will show up here and there, but a lot of times they're off doing things around the world, like building a hydroelectric dam in South America. And so he can't be in this adventure.
Pecos can't always be there when the Hong Kong Cavaliers New Jersey.
So it's, so for him to show up and only have two speaking words, two speaking lines in the entire book, that's not a surprise.
Okay.
Yeah. If the thing that always got me, and I had, there's back in the days of Amalgam Comics in the 90s, there was a running gag where the Reed Richards character, who was also an analog of Prof Haley from the Challengers of the Unknown, his catchphrase was, "I'll be super amalgamated," which is stolen from Johnny.
Oh, yeah.
And Yeah, and that's the thing. I did not realize until after I had read Amalgam Comics in 1995 that that was stolen from him. So every once in a while in here, that would pop up because I remember him saying it. And I'm like, oh, wait, it's a reference to them. Oh, no, it's not.
Yeah, no. There are a lot of things that people have lifted over the years. You're right. Buckaroo Banzai is really just a veiled reference to Doc Savage.
You know,
Doc Savage came out in 1936. He is the Man of Bronze. Superman comes out in 1938. He is the Man of Steel. Doc Savage has the Fortress of Solitude. Guess what? Superman also has the Fortress of Solitude. So there's a lot of things that Doc did first.
Doc Savage wears that disco vest. Superman wears those weird disco underpants.
Yeah. So the second story is more in tune with what a lot of Doc Savage tales are like, in that there's some kind of what appears to be a supernatural mystery or force doing something, and then Doc investigates and finds a plot and solves the mystery, the end, and uses his strength and, you know, uses his golden flecked eyes. And when he thinks really deep thoughts, there's this trilling sound that you hear. They use rubber bullets, you know, that's before Batman. So Doc is using rubber bullets long before Batman would. He sends people upstate and has their minds wiped by doing a little procedure called a lobotomy on people so that they're no longer criminals. Yeah, I mean, back in the 1930s, it was shock treatments or lobotomies, right?
Yeah.
So, he sends them upstate and performs lobotomies.
My workplace, either shock treatment or a lobotomy. That's the only way out.
Yeah.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that his hair?
It is his hair. So here's the interesting thing. In the original incarnation of Doc Savage, he has normal, regular comb-over hair. Right. In fact, it's described as a very bronzish colored hair. When Bantam got the reprints of the Doc Savage books in the late 60s and early 70s, and they commissioned James Bama to paint these really cool covers for this, the head editor at Bantam looked at this and said, "These are old stories. The art that you've painted is great, but this guy looks like their grandfather. There's no way that young kids today are going to pick up this cover with this old man on here." Change his hair into something more sci-fi. And so Bama went back and painted in this Widow's Peak skull cap thing that we see. And that is how, and it was only to get people to look at the covers and go, "Wow, this guy looks modern and cool and hip, and I got to pick up this book." And somehow that is the look that has stuck all this time. If you see the model that Bama based Doc Savage on for his paintings, that guy doesn't have a skull cap. He's got regular hair. In fact, he's really a cool looking dude.
He does look like a fighting grandpa.
Yeah.
He does. Yeah.
Like, well, you know, back in the day, when you look at your grandpa's pictures,
yeah,
it's like, oh man, my grandpa could beat people up with that.
Yeah.
Come over.
And so, unfortunately, like
5'7", but he'll punch you.
Unfortunately, that is one thing that people latched onto because, again, in the 1970s, you have the comic books, you have the book reprints. 1975, you have the movie from Warner Brothers that came out and failed. And everybody just was like, "We got to latch onto this skull cap as his hair for all time in all incarnations." And I hate it. I hate it with a passion.
It looks so good, though. On the issue 2 has a Steranko cover, and my God, it looks beautiful. And the Bama, those Bama paperbacks are so striking. That was, you know, when I was young, the only thing I knew about Doc Savage was
were the covers. Yeah.
Big hair wedge, and I'm just like, wow, this is really cool.
So I was always confused. I know we've done some form of Doc Savage before.
And we've talked about it here and there.
So I think I had asked that question before and had just forgotten because it's like, it's so weird. Right. And I think when I was a kid and I came across Doc Savage stuff, because in Mexico back in the 90s, it was a free for all. Like, who knows who had the rights to anything? And often you don't, even if you don't have the rights, things get printed. Mm-hmm. I would see that and assume that it was some sort of cap. like what Eclipso wears. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like,
yep.
There's like a specific sort of like medieval lackey cap that that I always assumed this was. And so I was always like looking around. And even today when I was looking around, I was like, does he ever take that off? Is that actually supposed to be his hair?
It's supposed to be his hair.
Yeah.
I have shared three images with you. The original, the first cover of the Doc Savage magazine, where he has flowing hair. The original Bama art, where it is more combed over, but still close to the head. And then the final version when they put in the skull.
I mean, it could have been worse. They could have like given him pointy ears or something.
Oh, yeah. No. They could have.
It would have been critical. I would watch that.
I mean, Doc Savage is always described as a man who is deeply tanned. But if you look at that original cover for the Doc Savage reprint book, an argument might be made that maybe Doc Savage is of a mixed race. And maybe why Dwayne The Rock Johnson has always been interested in playing Doc Savage.
Sure.
So,
you know, I feel like he should.
I think he should too. They just never can get the story is that he and Shane Black can't get their schedules lined up.
See, and that is kind of the thing. One of the big issues that I've always had with Doc Savage is, much like The Shadow, we are kind of tied to a very limited sort of canon.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. You know, I definitely understand the whys and the wherefores of it. And I feel like as a comic book fan, I'm used to more of an elasticity in the way that a character, you know, operates. Batman can be a two-fisted, smiling vigilante working for, you know, Commissioner Gordon, and also the dark vigilante of the night who is, you know, just floating around and nobody knows what he is. And he's in the Justice League, but he's also an urban legend. And I kind of feel like, really, honestly, a modern Doc Savage take, and I don't mean modern as in the modern day, but like a modern take on the tropes where it's 1930-something.
Yeah, 1935, 1936.
It's 1930, not quite World War II.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it's going to be, and that's what it always has to be. And then you go and you do something cool with it. You do something like a Kingsman, or you do something like, what was that weird movie with Samuel L. Jackson?
The Kingsman?
No, the other one.
The Spectre.
Yeah, that one.
Oh, God.
No, I hated The Spectre. How dare you?
The problem is that, there are a lot of uncomfortable bits in Doc Savage. And you're right. We've only got 180 stories of Doc Savage. They have tried to do new stories. Philip Jose Farmer has written a couple of those. He certainly has written the definitive Doc Savage biography.
But he's also written the whole alternate reality thing, and
the people that I know who really buy into Doc Savage
really don't like the Jose Farmer.
Oh no, I think a lot of them are fine with it. In the way that it's presented, I think if you're going to do it, I think you have to try your best. Here's the problem: you're going to have to try your best to remove all of the uncomfortable bits, right? Because there's a lot of that stuff that pops up in the stories, which I really hope that if they do a Doc Savage movie, that they don't do the Man of Bronze, the first book, which is the first two issues that we read of this, because it is so problematic and it's been done to death, to be honest. Yeah. And I think that they could, I think Shane Black, I think could do a very good story in that sense. I think they should try to not make it goofy, because that's where it's going to get problematic, right? If you try to make it too silly, and you don't make it a straight up adventure with humor,
right,
then I think people are going to look at this and go, what is this? This is horrible. What was Dwayne The Rock Johnson thinking about? Mm-hmm. So I think it has to do something that uses a lot of the bits that nobody knows about Doc Savage. I think mm-hmm. you use those very common things. I don't think you give him a hairpiece at all. I think you let Dwayne The Rock Johnson keep his hair shaved. And just go about it that way.
Honestly, Dwayne The Rock Johnson's hair looks like this.
Oh, yeah, it does in real life, yeah.
When he's playing Smolder Bravestone or something.
Yeah,
Doc Savage hair.
No, yeah.
And then, at the end of the movie, we find out that somebody has been financing this whole thing, and their name is Lamont Cranston.
Well, the
and it's like pa 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 the Pulpiverse.
So, Doc Savage's arch nemesis, who appears in several books, is John Sunlight. Yeah. So you got that going with you, but I don't know. A part of me is like, I really would love to see a very current, modern take set in a period piece with Doc Savage, as you said, Matthew. But right. Part of me thinks that every studio is going to go, oh, period pieces are too expensive. Set Doc Savage in the modern day. And Doc Savage doesn't work in the modern day. And that's why every comic book incarnation of Doc Savage has ultimately failed, because they try to say, let's bring him to the modern day. DC did that in the 1980s. I think Dynamite tried to do it.
They did it again in the 2010s.
Yeah, there was a series. There was a series in the 2000s from, I forget what the publisher is.
Innovation.
Maybe it was Innovation. They tried to bring him into modern day, and it's just like, no, it doesn't work, because Doc Savage is a relic of his time period. Yeah. Doc Savage today would be the equivalent of, I mean,
Howard Hughes.
No, because Howard Hughes is a byproduct of the 1930s, right? I'm trying to think of somebody who would be the equivalent of Doc Savage today, and there isn't one. And so he's going to feel out of place and stupid.
Well, there is, but they're not going to like it. Like, who is the analog of Doc Savage today? It's Greta Thunberg.
To an extent, yeah. To an extent, it's like, yes.
Like, athlete, adventurer, activist, Doc Savage wasn't an activist, but activism basically didn't exist back then.
Right.
So it's
He was very much, let's do the right thing. Of course,
yeah,
a lot of it
people.
Is wrapped
Absolutely.
Up.
See, it's, that's a lot of what it's I'm wrapped saying. Up. They're not going to like it.
Yeah.
They're not going to like it, because when you say, okay, who is the right age and has all of these things that also are like, take all of these things and make them relevant today,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. All of these things that Doc Savage stands for, like knowledge and science, but also physical strength and all this stuff, is like, first off, this person is already either a Gen Z or a millennial, right? If you want to have like a 40-year-old Doc Savage, you can do a millennial, but otherwise it's going to be Gen Z. And it's like, all of these things, when you translate them into the modern world and you want to keep them positive, they're not going to like them, because Doc Savage is going to be out there like basically fighting like the proxy jerks of the American government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's like, they're not going to like that.
Yeah. Do you guys remember the movie Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito?
Yes.
Yes.
The Arnold Schwarzenegger character's origin story is very similar to Doc Savage's origin story, in that Doc was trained from a very young age to be the peak of everything. I can't remember. I don't think he was raised on an island, but he was raised by the most brilliant minds in the world, the most brilliant everybody's in the world, to train him to be the perfect specimen, which is what they were doing in Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger's character.
Right.
So, yeah, just a little thing I want to drop in.
Another issue, right? It's that,
I mean, so many issues.
Obviously, all of, yeah. And that's why you might as well just not, right? It's like, you think about Doc Savage, he's so tied up in all of these things. And it's like, even if you remove like all of the like horrible outward like racism and misogyny, it's like, you scoop that out, like, what are you left with? Lots of little bits of racism, misogyny, race science, like eugenics.
Yeah.
Like, all of this stuff is just like so soaked into the fabric of it that is like, why even try?
Yeah. And that's probably another reason why Shane Black has not come up with his script. I think he said it's done, but he has never leaked anything on it and says he's still working on it. But
it's like,
I don't think we're ever going to see it.
You can go back and enjoy Doc Savage stories for what they are.
Oh, yeah. 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 Like, yeah.
I think that's perfectly fine. And like, as far as like, the history of like American fiction, these are American, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, the history of American fiction, like, Doc Savage is important and Doc Savage is worth studying. But when you say, how do you make a modern version of Doc Savage? It's have
Superman.
To break it so hard that it doesn't make sense anymore, or you have to keep things that are going to be unpalatable.
Yeah. For modern. No, seriously, Doc Savage is Superman. So
yeah, I agree, and that's
the thing, and we've already got Superman out in the world, so we really don't need Doc Savage.
We keep saying these, you know, these takes of characters like the Phantom, like, you know, G8 and his battle aces, like the Shadow, these almost proto superhero characters. And when they try to bring them forward, when they try to modernize them or do them, by modernizing them, you've made them a superhero. But by making Doc Savage a superhero, you've negated Doc Savage, because the point of Doc Savage was superheroes didn't exist in 1936.
Yeah, you had the pulp heroes, so.
Exactly. And you have this character who is, by definition, absolutely not, cannot be a superhero. He is not a superhero. That is the whole point of Doc Savage. And yet, everything about him screams out superhero, which is why I think the art in this is so distressing to you, because
it's
a superhero costume. It is flat out, I'm going to put on a vest and this is going to be my superhero costume.
Like, seriously, like, if you look up what Eclipso looks like, it's basically what Doc Savage is wearing. You know,
if you look closely on the covers, you know, he has a little S on his belt buckle. And I'm like, I don't think that's part of the thing, is it?
So you know,
you're just like, hey, I'm Doc Savage, but I'm not a superhero.
So
I just play one on TV.
I think that there is one way in which they could do it and sort of keep people happy, and that's if they made a movie about Doc Savage's team. Like, you have a monk, you have a ham, you have all of these guys, you turn a couple of them into girls, and then you have them have adventures, and then at some point, they're like, okay, we got to bring Doc Savage in. It's like, we can't. He's in the Arctic in an expedition. And so they're like, they're just like struggling the whole time until Doc Savage shows up and saves the day. But then, you know, he makes it a point to say, like, well, none of this would be possible if you guys hadn't, like, investigated these mysterious murders, or like, blah, blah, blah. So thank you, my team. Off to the Amazon I go.
There are several stories that are like that, where Doc is out of the country, or as he's at his Fortress of Solitude and is not able to be reached. And so then you get Rennie or Long Tom and Ham and Brooke teaming up and having their adventure. And then Doc shows up or calls in and says, you guys are doing a great job, or whatever. There have been those stories.
And that's the thing, is like, when you have a character that's like weirdly incongruous, like Doc Savage became today, it's hard to do that. But if they have a team, you can focus on the team. It's like, nowadays, it would actually, like, people are like, the time for a Captain Planet remake has come, you know, like, people are more aware of environmental, like, big crises than we have ever been. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what it is, it's a great time to make a movie about the Planeteers, right? About like five kids who have like rings that give them superpowers, and maybe by the end of the movie Captain Planet shows up, but that's less interesting than a bunch of kids from different continents trying to come together and fix these problems by punching capitalists and polluters in the face.
I don't know. I think that I have no problem with anything that you've said. There would be a lot of 50 to 70 year olds that would be dropping dead of heart attacks based on that, which might be a great way to clean up the toxicity in the fandom. But I think, you know, we have seen them try to do Defenders of the Earth in modern times. And there's just something weird about Defenders the Phantom and Mandrake and Lothar running around in modern day times that just doesn't work. And I think that we have seen what happens when you try to take the Shadow and turn him into Batman.
Right.
I really think that, and I'm not saying that Doc Savage can't have a resurrection, because I think, as I said, every comic book publisher is like, oh, it's the 2010s. I think we could do our take on Doc Savage. And then they try to bring him in the modern day and it doesn't work. I think that it might be Doc Savage, like a lot of the other pulp heroes, are products of their time, and they either need to stay in there or they have probably run out of fuel. I'm not saying that Doc Savage can't come back in a modern incarnation, even set in a period piece. because we saw it happen in the 70s, 30s to the 70s, and we kind of missed that anniversary. Well, we're coming up on a 100-year anniversary of Doc Savage in about a decade. So there could be something that happens there, but I just don't see modern audiences, readers, etc., taking a look at Doc Savage and going, gee willikers, I'll be super amalgamated that I want to go and see what it was like in the 1920s and see some really uncomfortable stuff that's going on.
Yeah, well, it's funny because part of the thing that's keeping Doc Savage from coming back is that it's so influential, right?
Yeah.
It's like, like you said, we already have Superman. We already have like all of these guys, right? Like Tom Strong is like,
Tom Strong is Doc Savage. Yeah.
Yeah. Like just at every level, like we have like indie Doc Savages. We have like big corporate Doc Savages. Like it's full, like a big, strong man. That's very smart. Like we're full up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. He's been done and redone in so many different ways, and people have picked all the parts of Doc Savage and imbued them into their characters that we don't. I don't know. I don't think we do. And I would certainly say here's what I'll say about these four issues. If you can find them in their single issues, you're probably going to pay about $1 for them in reading condition, maybe a little bit less. They can be really hard to find. I know that I spent at least 10 years trying to collect all four of these issues that we have read just because it was difficult to find them in print form. They aren't great stories. They're super rushed. They're super forced in a lot of places, but I do like the art, even though I complained about it at the very beginning because it is this weird thing, but it is very 1970s Marvel stuff. So if you are a diehard fan of Doc Savage, chances are you've already read this. If you're a diehard fan of Doc Savage and you haven't read these comics, definitely go and try and track them down in some way, shape, or form. If you don't know anything about Doc Savage, I don't think I would recommend this as the place to start with the comics. There's better, like I said, I think the Dynamite ones from not too long ago did okay. So I would go and check that out first. So final thoughts from you, Matthew.
The thing about this, I don't know if you and I differ on reading copies. You're probably going to pay about $5 an issue for these. They are hard to find. And because of the array of talent involved, you've got Steranko covers, you've got some Kane covers. They're worth looking into if you're just a nerd into comic nerdery, wanting to see Andrew inked by Jim Moody, Andrew inked by Ernie Chan, and, you know, Ross Andrew inked by a bunch of people that you don't necessarily see him working with. And most importantly, the thing that you really need to know about this series is that this is Doc Savage in the Marvel Universe. He actually crosses over with both The Thing in Marvel 2-in-1 and Spider-Man in Marvel Team-Up during his Marvel run. So that might also change the question of whether you're interested. And I'm not going to argue which way it goes. But for me, it's interesting to read these and see the lens, I guess, through which comics of the 1970s looked at the pulps, which were kind of their source material. So definitely, if you share my expectation of, hey, the history of comics, the way they're done, the people doing them are as interesting as the books themselves, absolutely worth checking it out. If you want a really good Doc Savage story, this is not where you're going to want to go.
Yeah, especially the second story. It's really weird. They introduce Doc Savage's cousin Pat. She first appeared in Brand of the Werewolf, which was like the second story, not this one. So, I mean, they can't even get that part straight. So, bah, Rodrigo, final thoughts from you.
I mean, I opened this book and was immediately hit by just like racism, pretty much directed exactly at me.
Yeah.
So it's hard to recommend. I think that it's probably not a great take on Doc Savage. Like, if you isolate all of the issues, like, it's just kind of not a good take because they're trying to do Doc Savage in the Marvel Universe, and maybe that just doesn't work. So I would say these are probably going to be hard to find, so don't worry too much about finding them. Maybe look for something else, Doc Savage, to read.
Now, listen, if you are a Doc Savage fan and you have those Bantam reprints that you're looking to unload and you want to donate them to me, I'll gladly take them off your hands because I like them for the stories and for the just for the designs of the books. And of course, the Bama art on the cover is really cool. Some people in the past have donated some of the books to me, and I'm very grateful for those. It's not like I'm going to turn around and sell them as a collection on eBay or anything like that. So if you're looking to just donate your old Bantam Doc Savage books, I'll gladly take those off your hands. But I'm going to pass on this comic book. So there you go. All right, that wraps it up for this week, and we got some other stuff coming. Don't worry, this is the last we're going to hear of, well, kind of hear of Matthew and Rodrigo for the rest of the year, because we've got a couple of greatest hits and a special presentation coming your way as we wrap up 2023, and we head into 2024, and we're very glad that you have been with us on our journey this year, and if you found value in this show or any of the shows that we have produced in 2023, we would love for you to come and join us over on our Major Spoilers Patreon. You can join the Patreon for a low, low price, $5 a month at patreon.com/majorspoilers, where you will get access to the Major Spoilers podcast pre-show. And in the pre-show this week, we talked a little bit about something that you didn't hear in the first part of this show. You can find that at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Next week, we are talking about the life and times of Scrooge McDuck. Why? Because we know that you love comics, and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Fat the X-ray vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. When I think about a better way, if I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven, rich like a man of iron, might not be surprised to find that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. Would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being in the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2023 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.